Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Theater-Podcast für die Dame mit einer Vorliebe für QVC und einer Obsession für die Schlank- und Stützprodukte. Heute mit einer neuen Folge aus New York. Wie lebt es sich eigentlich als Schauspieler in dieser wahnsinnig teuren Stadt? Wie ergibt sich das und wie geht es überhaupt? Zu Gast diesmal ist Wyatt Fenner. Seit er ein Kind ist, spielt er Theater, wurde an der University of Southern California ausgebildet und kennt deshalb auch die Theaterszene in Los Angeles ganz gut und ist sowohl auf der Bühne als auch in TV- und Filmproduktionen unterwegs. So zum Beispiel in dem tollen Indie-Film Chrissy Judy, in dem er eine der beiden Titelrollen spielt. Also, Einblicke eines Working Actors in das Theaterleben in den USA. Viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Wyatt Fenner.
I grew up with all sorts of art and culture. What comes to mind first is being read to before bed, because when I was little, dad would have me in his bed at, you know, after bath time, before bedtime, and he wouldn't read me picture books. He would read me literature. He read me Peter Pan, Tom Sawyer, Huck Finn. And I remember, this edition of Peter Pan that I still have, that was our copy, there were illustrations every 20 pages, sometimes every 30 pages. And I remember one time, and I loved the illustrations, and one time I asked him, how many more pages until a picture? And he said, well, with this book, you get to have the pictures in your head while you hear the words. And I remember, I was really little. I was, you know, probably like 4 years old, 5 years old. And I remember recognizing the power of my imagination without having the language to say the power of my imagination. But picturing the Mermaid's Lagoon as dad was reading to me about it. And then from there, I, you know, got into the public school system where we had music programs, but there weren't any theater programs in my elementary school. So really my imaginative world was based on my own imagination and going out at recess and playing imaginary games with my friends. My imagination has always been, but as a little kid, it was enormously just captivated me all the time. And so I remember during class, I would sit there, you know, having daydreams all day long. And then as soon as we got released for recess to go outside, I would get a gang of my friends together and we would all start playing the imaginary games of, for example, Peter Pan, you know, The Little Mermaid, 101 Dalmatians, just playing pretend, not realizing at that point in my life that there was something called the theater. I was at a library with my mom when I was seven, and there was a poster on the wall advertising a children's theater production of The Velveteen Rabbit. And I had trouble reading. I didn't start reading until I was like seven and a half or so. So I couldn't fully read this poster, but I recognized the picture of the rabbit as the Velveteen Rabbit's book cover. And I asked Mom, what is that? And she said, that's a children's theater. And I said, what's children's theater? And she said, they make stories on a stage and people act them out. People create them. And I was like, that's for me.
Okay. Yeah. So it was not like your parents took you to the theater.
No, I mean, they did then, you know, like there was, I was too little to audition for that production, but it was like the next one that happened, which was a few months later. I then was old enough and also could read better. So then I was able to audition and my mom took me to audition for a children's theater production of a play called Sing Ho for a Prince, which was an adaptation of Sleeping Beauty.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I played one of the fairies. Go figure. Yeah.
So what kind of household was this? Like, what were your parents doing, or what did your parents like culturally or the arts?
My parents listened to a lot of music. They definitely weren't theater people by any means. You know, they had an appreciation for it, but it wasn't something that was a part of the house. When they realized I was interested in the theater, it became a big part of the house. I'm the youngest of four. So my older siblings, they hadn't been into it in the same way or kind of really at all. They were into sports and other things. But then once I got interested in the theater, my birthday's in July. So every Christmas and every birthday, my big gifts were trips up here to New York to see Broadway shows. Mm-hmm. So every Christmas I would get, you know, a weekend or two weekends that Dad and I would take the train up to New York, and over the weekend we would see six Broadway shows over the course of 3 days. Yeah. And then that would sort of last me until July, when my birthday would come around, and then I would get, you know, a couple more trips that I got to do with Dad or Dad and Mom.
Yeah.
I grew up in Arlington, Virginia, which is right outside of Washington, D.C. Mm-hmm. And D.C. is one of the places where a lot of national touring companies will stop. So anything that was coming on a national tour into D.C., we went and saw.
You saw plays and musicals? Both.
Both, yeah. Okay. And it, like when I was, I mean, I was really young when I started acting. I did my first plays with the Children's Theater. And then I started working professionally as a kid in DC, mm-hmm. Playing children in productions that needed a boy. And the Shakespeare Theater Company in DC was one company that I got involved with really young. Michael Kahn is a phenomenal director here in America, and I've known him since I was like 8 years old. Mm-hmm. And Dad and I would go together and see everything at the Shakespeare Theater way before I had an understanding of what it was that I was watching, like The Duchess of Malfi, mm-hmm. or, you know, Richard III, Hamlet, anything that was playing, he and I would go and check out. Yeah.
Did you also listen to cast albums?
I listened to every single Broadway recording that the Sam Goody record store in the Ballston Mall had. I mean, the first CD I ever bought in my life was the original Broadway cast recording of A Chorus Line. And I listened to that thing nonstop. Caitlin Perminsky is a girl that I grew up with, who's still a friend of mine. And she and I actually were in the first play that I ever did, Sing Ho for a Prince. Mm-hmm. Our moms carpooled. So Caitlin and I became really close. And one or two weekends, my parents were out of town, and I stayed at Caitlin's house for a weekend sleepover, mm-hmm. and we watched the film version of A Chorus Line like five times through. And this was when we were like nine, you know? So then when I was 10, 11, I got into the cast recording of A Chorus Line. And then from there, it was like everything. Yeah. And, you know,
it was probably CDs already.
CDs, yeah. I had a couple.
You still have them?
I'm sure. I mean, I have my Les Mis CD. I have my A Chorus Line CD. And Mom, one of the rules that Mom and Dad had about like what I could do as far as plays were concerned was it can be within a 40-minute driving distance from our house. So if it was further than that, they were like, oh, it's really too far for us to be driving you to get to rehearsals and performances. Although there were times that I was doing plays that were like an hour away, and they fudged it. But Mom and I would listen to cassettes of Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, Les Miserables, Rent, obviously, nonstop on those car rides, her driving me to and from rehearsals.
Yeah.
Amazing. It was really special.
Yeah. So there was obviously no question that you were becoming an actor.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was clear to me from
from day one.
Yeah. I mean, the moment I was standing in a hallway waiting to audition for Sing Ho for a Prince, this new version of Sleeping Beauty, and I was in a line of kids waiting to eventually go in and audition for this, and I was just like, this is it.
Yeah.
Just the auditioning, you know, not even doing the play. I was just like, this is it. I'm going to get in that room and I'm going to have the time of my life.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was, you know, and then I got cast in the play, and it was just, I'm never going back.
How old were you then?
Nine.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. Eight or nine. I was a kid.
Yeah. So you were one of those show, like a really like a show kid, like a theater kid.
Yeah, I mean, it was my life. It is my life still. I mean, it's, you know, it's like as you grow up and as you mature, you realize like any one thing can't be your whole life. And as a kid, you don't get that. You know, you're just obsessed with the theater, and I fully was. I came to understand, like, to be an artist, you have to be multifaceted. You have to care about things other than, you know, cast recordings.
Yeah.
But as a little one, you know, that it was hard for that to sort of like occur to me for a good many years.
Yeah. Where did you get your training then? Or did you get training? Because you did it like your whole life.
Well, you know, I did. And there was a question of whether or not I was going to, because I started doing plays in DC as a kid and was doing that really consistently because, I mean, like it's still the case in your career, you work with people, then you continue to work with people. And especially when you're a child actor, if they like having you around and if they, I'm assuming they like dealing with your parents, it's like they're going to continue to have you be the kid who's doing these parts. So I did a lot of that. And I knew I was going to continue to be an actor. And I remember sort of thinking, I don't know, like, do I need to go to school? And it wasn't so much do I need to go to school as ultimately it was, well, I want to have that experience. So I auditioned for several conservatories and got to sort of then just choose which one I was most interested in. And I decided to go to the University of Southern California because I wanted to have a college experience that was like a college experience and be in an acting training program, which is what the BFA program at USC offered. So that was when I moved out to Los Angeles and I was there for my undergrad and studied acting and also got to just be a college student. You know, USC is a very phenomenal collegiate experience. There's frat row and keggers and football games and everything that you would hope to experience in college, as well as the drama program, which is a phenomenal school.
How was the drama program? What did you have to do there?
It was interesting for me because I had never taken classes. I had only ever been, I had only ever done the work. And I am really grateful for everything that I learned at school. And I also think ultimately you do the work. It's, you're going to understand the physicality and, you know, we studied Grotowski, which was great for me because that's a technique that addresses how your brain doesn't stop in your head. Your whole nervous system is your brain. So as an actor, you're using every part of your body to experience what your character is going through. And that is what is allowing the audience to then experience what you and your character are experiencing. So being able to have a language and an understanding of that being put through the physical drills and the warm-ups that are a part of the Grotowski technique was huge for me. I was doing all of that. Now I had techniques and language for what that was. And I also was given a practice that I could access, you know, and that I can now still access in my work in an intentional way. So it was terrific. You know, my Linklater teacher is a woman named Natsuko Oyama, who I think of every single day because of the way that she helped me to intentionally engage with my breath and with my emotional accessibility. And that was always something that has always been something that is a part of the fabric of who I am. School and training allowed me to get a hold of it and to, you know, like a musician with an instrument, allowed me to understand what it is that I'm capable of doing in specific intentional ways.
Yeah. What kind of texts did you work on?
Oh, all sorts of stuff. We, you know, we worked on classical texts, Shakespeare and Marlowe and Ben Jonson. And we also worked on more contemporary classical texts like Eugene O'Neill and Arthur Miller and all of the Tennessee Williams, the American classics. And then we also did a lot of work with Chekhov and Strindberg and Ibsen.
Yeah.
And we worked on contemporary playwrights as well. I mean, it was really, we had scene study every single semester. I mean, we had a scene study class all the time. And so several days a week, we would be working on different texts. And we also had, you know, lecture courses on theater history. And it was great because once I got out of school, I was able to experience the first time in my life where I was reading for myself. Because of all of school that I had had at that point, I enjoyed reading because I had been given these really amazing pieces of literature to absorb and to think about and to discuss with my classmates. Then when I was done with school, I was in a position where I was like, wait, I just get to choose anything I want and I get to engage with that because it's what I'm into. I had been introduced to this part of myself by all of these years of being a thirsty, hungry theater kid, hungry for theater, hungry for ideas, hungry for literature. And then by going and being in a training program that gave me all of these like cherry picked gems of literature and of theatrical history, you know, and Andrew and I, when we were in London a couple weeks ago, we saw several different productions of Chekhov's plays. And it's like, as you move through your life, these pieces of theater affect you differently at different stages in your life. And I know that when I was a college student, I had a different understanding of the Cherry Orchard than I do now as a more grown man. But I am so grateful to have been introduced to those ideas as a young person. I'm a book nerd. I always will be. Reading is a really important part of every day of my life.
And after training, when did you decide to go to New York? Or was it clear for you that if you were, you, New York is my...
No, not at all. No, it wasn't clear at all. I got out of school and I started working. I mean, the parts that I was playing for the first 10 years of my adult life post graduating from school were teenage boys. Because I still looked like a teenage boy. But I had this emotional accessibility that, whatever. I was playing characters much younger than me for a long time. Okay. And I was just doing the work that was coming around and loving it. But I was doing a lot of new play development in Los Angeles. And there's so much theater in LA. Mm-hmm. A lot of the theater in LA, a lot of the new plays that I was developing were plays that were being written by playwrights who were based in New York. So I was spending a lot of time with people who were coming from New York to LA to work on these plays. And after a certain amount of time, it felt to me like I should go and see what's there because I was really, I mean, I love Los Angeles. And I'll be so happy to be living in LA and in New York at the point in our life when that's what makes sense.
Yeah.
But at that time, there was something about not having been here that it was clear to me I should do that. And I had spent, you know, all of my adult life at that point growing into myself in Los Angeles. So it was pretty wild, you know, I was 30 when I came here. But I'm so incredibly grateful that I did because it has... not only in my work, but also in my life, you know, completely expanded what it was that I was supposed to be experiencing.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't related to theater, but Andrew and I met like one of the first weekends that I was here and he and I had been in theater camp together when we were little boys. So Andrew and I had the children's theater company that I did plays with also had a summer camp and Andrew and I both attended that camp when we were nine, you know, little boys. And we did that summer camp several summers in a row and we went to different high schools, different colleges, you know, didn't see each other for 20 years. And then coincidentally, we were both invited to the same weekend upstate and he was living in DC at the time. But my point is just all aspects of my life developed and blossomed in a way that I could never have expected had I not decided to move to New York.
What I found super interesting what you just said is that there's a big theater scene in LA. I would have thought it's just a movie, it's a city for the movies, Hollywood.
It's like a regional theater town. The way that any other city in America has their good regional theater, Los Angeles has incredible theater, but it's not sort of international. It's not always. Sometimes things are happening that are getting a lot of international, national attention in Los Angeles, as they all deserve to be getting, because the work that's being done on stage in LA is phenomenal.
Okay.
But it's not New York. It's not Broadway,
yeah,
you know?
That's the thing.
So
everybody
it's,
looks at Broadway.
Exactly. So because of that, you wouldn't know. The thing about Los Angeles, that's one thing about Los Angeles that's so incredibly wonderful, is there are so many talented, intelligent people in Los Angeles, and not necessarily are those talented, intelligent, wonderful people being employed, creatively fulfilled, given the opportunities in film and television all the time to be doing the work that they are dedicating their lives to. And so there are companies in Los Angeles that afford these incredible actors the opportunity to work on classical texts, new plays, all sorts of different pieces of theater that are just absolutely brilliant, that are less visible than the film and television work that they're doing that anyone can watch anytime online or on a movie screen.
You know what totally is like ingrained into my brain, or what I see when you talk about Los Angeles theater, which is obviously wrong, is this like every comedy show or every has the scene where one of the actor friends does some crazy performance in some... in front of three people in LA.
And look,
that's the thing.
Look,
it
happens too. Like it doesn't matter where you're doing theater. There will be situations where you are doing a play for seven people.
Yes.
And in hindsight, we all have.
Yeah, yeah.
And in hindsight, you're gonna smile at those experiences. You know, when I was in college, I did an evening of Eugene O'Neill one acts, and one. There were seven of us in the play, and one night we performed the play for three people, my mom, my college roommate, and we were pretty sure a homeless person who came into the theater to like have a place to chill, who just slept in the back row. And we were like, okay, well, Wyatt's mom is here tonight, so we're gonna do the play. And we did. We did these Eugene O'Neill one acts. The Spider's Web was the name of one of them. But there's also, and so I totally understand what you're saying about that idea, but there's also the actual experience of the art. Yeah. When you realize you're seeing the greatest production of All My Sons you've ever encountered, because these actors and this director have realized it so brilliantly. It's a wonderful theater town. That said, I did do a production of Romeo and Juliet where I played Juliet, and the theater was a really tiny storefront theater next to a karate studio.
Oh yeah.
And on Saturday afternoons while we were doing our matinee, they had children's karate classes next door. So when I was doing the balcony scene, you could hear these little children next door doing, "Hi, yeah, oh, yeah, hi. Yeah, just like this subtle little whisper of children's voices doing their karate drills.
Like birds.
Just like birds chirping in the garden. In the Capulet's garden. Absolutely. Just
hilarious. In Germany, we have this like state-funded theater.
Yeah.
You don't have like state-funded theater in America. So when I compare like this mainstream theater in Germany and then this mainstream theater in America, I would look at Broadway probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is your state theater,
right?
In one way, although it's not state funded. Is there any way you could describe Broadway theater? You know, the cliche about German theater, for example, is like super heady, super dark.
Sure, abstract, very like you know, like bright white faces and black clothes and black hair and I mean,
so in this way, how would you describe like American theater?
Well, see, that's interesting because I would describe American theater as an expression, a service, you know. As a theater artist, I would describe American theater as a necessity to facilitate community.
Yeah.
I would also say that the idea of Broadway, I think, is probably, you know, the flashy, celebratory, at the moment, you know, movies turned into musicals type of experience. And I think there's something wonderful about that because it is a uniquely connective experience. You bring thousands of people into one room and cause them to laugh or cry at the same moment. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But I do think that there's something at the moment that is sometimes a little more creation by committee theater. There's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. Whereas something like Oh Mary, yeah, it's so unique because it's an example of a piece of theater that a really brilliant person created from themselves. And then they found a really unique collection of people to bring together to put it on stage. And then that thing that they made together, that small group of people, became what is now the biggest show on Broadway. But that's not a common thing for a Broadway show to occur in that way.
And it also seems to me that Broadway theater or American theater is like very story driven.
Yeah.
Character driven. Whereas in Germany or Europe, but let's stay in Germany, it's very expressive, very experimental. It's cut into the story. Story is the last thing.
Sure. And I can't speak to the German theatrical experience as a theater maker. Mm-hmm. But when I was in Berlin, I felt like something that was very apparent to me was that the companies had a really clear understanding of what it was that they as a company do and how each of the members of the company understood the work that the collective was interested in doing. Mm-hmm. And I feel like
In the individual
piece, as well as the type of work the company was interested in doing all the time, whether it's physical expression, emotional expression, vocal expression, or a combination of those things, these companies of actors, and it's the same thing with the Comédie Française in Paris, they have such a clear theatrical language among the company members. And it's less common to encounter that in America because we don't have repertory companies that are able to support a company of actors. The Oregon Shakespeare Festival it's going through it now, like all regional theaters in America, but it's one place where an actor used to be able to go for an entire season and have their living. And then they had long-term company members. They still do, but it's going through such a hard time. That's one place. I'm sure that there are other companies in America where they have an acting company, but it's so much less common. Whereas in Germany, there are people being a company member at the Schaubühne or at the Berliner Ensemble is their job. That is their job.
Yes.
And of course they can and do go and make films and television, but they have a job as an actor all the time. Every American actor I know, like myself, is a working man actor who is working the job that they have right now and is moving on to the next one when it's done. This year, I have in April, I have workshopped 4 plays. I've done 1 film. I've done 1 short film. Next week, I'm going to workshop another new play. And all the while I'm auditioning to facilitate 1 foot in front of the next in order to continue working, which is what we're used to. I think anyone would say that the idea of being able to have a company that you belonged to where you were a company member actor would be a total dream. And they tried to do it at Lincoln Center when they first, when they first started Lincoln Center, Ilya Kazan tried to start an American company.
Yeah.
Faye Dunaway was one of the first company members there, but it didn't, for whatever reason, it didn't work out.
She doesn't strike me as the ideal candidate for
Mommy Dearest.
No more wire hangers.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think that one difference that comes to mind for me is the European German way of creating theater to me seems closer to the actor, director, playwright, manager method of theater creation from way back centuries ago. You know, the Seventh Seal style of like a company of actors in a caravan going around the country, sharing their performances and then moving on to the next place, or, you know, the the booths, you know, the men who were like, okay, I'm going to be playing these roles. I'm going to direct the production. I'm going to tour it around America.
Right. Yeah.
That's not something that occurs as often anymore when someone is stepping up and saying, I'm going to be playing this leading role. I'm directing the production. I'm effectively producing it and managing it as well. And I'm taking this group of people with me to do it. Cola Scola, I think, has done that with Oh Mary, in a sense. They have said, I'm going to play Mary Todd Lincoln. I'm going to bring these actors together and I'm going to tell the story in this way. But that is not something that really exists as much anymore in America. Whereas many, many, many people being producers or being official decision makers or being able to contribute in a way that they think it's important for them to contribute, being a part of what eventually ends up on the stage, I think it is more common, especially on Broadway, from my perspective, which there's a lot of really amazing stuff that happens as a result of that. But I do think that theater as a form of expression is really empowered by a singular or a smaller collective expression being able to occur and being able to say to a group of really trusted collaborators, this is what we're doing together. This is what we're building together. And here's how we are going to do it. Our team. And so I am most excited by that sort of work, by doing that sort of work and by experiencing that sort of work.
But I imagine it to be so hard, like in a city that is so like money driven, to create an environment.
Well, so that this absolutely, can... because that's, I mean, that's why there need to be so many cooks in the kitchen, because those are people who are giving the money for the art to occur. And money's necessary, and naturally there's a sense of, okay, I'm going to give this much money. I also should probably be able to say whether or not I like the color of the hat that she's wearing in the second act. You know, Charles's work early in his career was all a group of, well, it was Charles, but it was at Charles and the group of people that he collected to forge their own way. And again, that's, he's an icon because that's uncommon, you know. A few of the projects that I've done that have been of that ilk I didn't make anything financially from doing these projects, but artistically and creatively, I got so much out of them, you know. And and there are cases where you get to do really, really, really incredible work that, and I've had so many experiences where I've done work that I'm so proud of, and I've made really good money. But they don't necessarily always end up going hand in hand in the theater industry here.
Yeah. You did this movie, Christmas, called Chrissy Judy.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about how it was produced or how it, the whole thing
happened? It was a very, very, very independent film.
Yes.
That was made on a, you know, shoestring, beyond shoestring budget, with basically scotch tape and dreams and determination. And then after we finished making the film, it was accepted to and went to a whole bunch of film festivals all over the world, because people were able to, you know, recognize what a wonderful little individual piece of art it is. And it basically came together because the filmmaker, the screenwriter and director, and I had workshopped a play before together years ago, years prior to making Chrissy Judy. And he asked me to come by and do a reading of the screenplay for him to just hear it out loud. And after that read through, it was clear to him that he wanted me to play the part. So then the following summer, or I guess it was, the summer began a couple of months later. We went out to Fire Island and had our first days of shooting on the beach in Fire Island at the end of May. And so those scenes where we're walking on the beach in Speedos, it was like 30 degrees. We were freezing, but making it look like a peak summertime.
It worked.
Good.
The illusion, that's Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we could like cut glass with our nipples those days because it was so cold. But, you know, whatever.
So it was like no budget at all? Or was there some?
I mean, there was like a teeny, teeny, tiny budget, but it was like the epitome of independent film, you know?
Okay.
It just making it work, making it happen, you know? Very guerrilla filmmaking, you know, showing up in the locations that we needed to be and getting what we needed. And Todd wanted to and did shoot the film sequentially. And the film takes place over a period of a summer. Mm-hmm. And so we started at the beginning of the summer, at the beginning of the screenplay, and then worked through the film, which is a really cool experience.
That is so interesting because that is what I wanted to ask you.
Yeah.
Like, did you shoot chronologically?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And we shot the entire film up and down the Eastern Seaboard. So we spent that summer traveling up and down the Eastern Seaboard to the different locations that Chrissy and Judy are in, you know, throughout the film. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was a really, really, really wonderful experience making the film.
Were there a lot of friends?
It's funny. Like, everyone who has seen the film, we have since become friends because you have an experience like that with someone and you're going to bond with them, Todd and I. But we had done a short workshop of a play together and that was it. So we didn't actually know each other like Chrissy and Judy do, but people who watch the film assume that we had been friends for, you know, 15 years, which is very cool because it's a testament to the success of the film. But that summer we bonded, and the other people working on the film, I mean, Brennan, the cinematographer, is Todd's brother. So that did allow for like a very familial, supportive environment throughout the process of making the filmmaker, because Todd, the director, and his brother Brendan obviously have like a very understanding language that they were able to access immediately.
Because sometimes you also have this, like, in if you watch like, or if I watch plays or something on stage, where you feel like in the beginning you can really see the actors like not looking for their parts, but you know, I think if the actors go on stage, maybe in the beginning they are a little nervous, blah, blah, and then they settle down and then they get more secure, which is part of the experience of theater sometimes.
Yeah.
And I had the same thing in the film. It was like there was this first scene where you were browsing through this, it was in this shop.
Yes, yes.
And you were looking around and I was like, it's a little bit like also like you are looking for like, how are we going to do this?
Very interesting.
And that's what I was asking, like, was this really the first scene they were shooting? Because you could, maybe it's just a director thing. Mm-hmm. I had the feeling like, oh, I can see how they settle into the roles like over the course of the
movie. Yeah, no, I understand.
And that's why I wanted to ask you, did you do it chronologically or did you do,
We did.
Oh, that's nice. But also the nice thing about producing something like independently is that you don't have to follow, like, sometimes I have the feeling in American movies, it's very formulaic.
Yes.
So there's a way to tell a story, those acts, and then the problem.
We were talking about, you know, creativity by committee, I think can really get in the way of artistic expression in some cases. And in this case, that was not an issue because the team was so small that it was able to be like, What is it that we're saying? And in fact, the final 20 minutes of the film, the original screenplay called for circumstances and locations and events that just we didn't have the capacity for in our independent film. And so Todd and I figured out the final 20 minutes of the film. That entire part of the film, that part of, you know, what you would call the screenplay, was something that we came up with together in order to facilitate finishing the film.
Yeah.
Because we realized like, oh, we can't get 200 extras and a night shoot with a beach bonfire and a psychedelic drug sequence. We need to finish this story in a different way that involves the two of us, which I think is very cool because I think the film at large has a very musical quality to it, where it starts as a duet, it goes into this sort of like aria of Judy's experience missing Chrissy and struggling through his own journey, And then Chrissy returns, and there's like this beautiful duet that finishes out the piece. Mm-hmm. The two of them recognizing, like, we don't know what's next, but we are going to put one foot in front of the next.
Yeah, that makes, for me, it makes it for us a very interesting watch, that it doesn't follow this, like, not classical Hollywood. I mean, it's not in Hollywood movies, that's clear, but that the narrative is, like, different than you usually see in film.
Totally.
So.
And also, like, the relationship that the film explores is not such that is usually investigated in film. You know, friendships, and not only friendships, but complicated, sort of difficult friendships are not common fodder for filmmaking. So I think
it's like, you don't really know, were they lovers?
Yes, exactly.
Are they friends?
Exactly.
What's going on? Are they having sex in between?
Totally. And gay relationships do often involve those complexities. And, you know, like in my mind, you know, Chrissy and Judy met when they were 19 years old in the halls of Ripley Greer Studios, waiting to go in for an open cattle call for summer stock auditions.
Yeah.
And Chrissy, my character, just immediately fell in love with Judy. And it was like, okay, well, is this going to happen or not? It turned into their years and years and years of friendship. And the crux of Chrissy's experience at the beginning of the film is basically sort of trying to say to Judy, are you ready to sort of man up and live your life in a more sort of responsible way, or do I need to go in another direction in order to grow in the ways that I do?
Yeah. You have a few scenes in drag.
Yeah.
Have you done drag before?
Never. No.
You should do it again.
Thank you.
It was so like that. There was this montage thing where you were doing your performance she's visiting you in
Philadelphia. Yeah.
It is so infectious.
Oh, thank you so much. I know. I've never done drag.
I would see the whole show. That's why I asked you, like, what is the middle part? What happens with her in Philadelphia? I want to see that.
Totally.
Part, the other half
totally.
Too.
Yeah. Chrissy's experience in Philadelphia. You know, like moving to a new city as a proper adult and trying to make friends is a complicated and difficult thing.
Yeah.
No, I've never done drag. I had never done drag before. I have never done drag since. I have played women.
But you had fun. It looks like you had fun.
Oh,
there.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that like one thing that is so important to just engage with when you're performing is that like what you're feeling is what the audience is going to be feeling. So if you're playing a drag performer and you're not having fun, the audience is not going to be along for the ride.
Yeah.
But
and there's also this moment of jealousy where Judy is watching.
Yeah, right?
Chrissy just having fun.
Yeah. And she's
so ambitious.
She's not a part of it.
Yeah. And she wants to really make this career out of it. And
which I think is also quite beautiful, because at the end of the film, and, you know, like people listening, please watch the film. And if you don't want to hear any spoilers, pause this and go watch the film. But at the end of the film, you get to see Chrissy experiencing Judy's performance. And there's a love for what Judy is getting to do, and Chrissy is in awe of and proud of and loving, and you know there's a tenderness there, a missing that they are not doing it together, but it's all with respect and appreciation. And the juxtaposition of those two responses to seeing someone you love succeed is very human and very complicated. I had played women. I'd never been in drag, but I played Juliet in a production of Romeo and Juliet, and I did the Carol Churchill play Cloud Nine, where I played Betty. So I'm very in touch with my feminine self. And as I was getting into the drag experience, my two drag inspirations are Shelley Duvall and Sarah Jessica Parker. So I just channeled the two of them and said, "This is me. Here I go."
Oh, I can see the Sarah Jessica Parker.
Oh, well, thank you very much. She was in the first Broadway show that I ever saw when I was a little kid with Dad and my brother. We came up and we saw Once Upon a Mattress, and I was like, this is it. This woman is everything. And that was before Sex and the City or anything. I was just like, this, she's my icon.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Shelley Duvall is Shelley Duvall. So come on.
Yeah.
How can you not? If you have the opportunity to channel an ultimate screen diva, it's going to be Shelley
But you
Duvall.
Haven't met Shelley Duvall.
No, I didn't get married. And you know, she, I think she passed away in the last year. Yesterday was her birthday.
Oh, I didn't know.
Happy birthday, Shelley.